طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And this is your host, John Roberts. This week we focus on water, the water crisis in Palestine, and we have as our guest Nidal Al-Azraq, Executive Director of the organization One for Three, that works all year to develop models for the preservation and sustainable use of water in Palestine. Nidal grew up in the Aida refugee camp in Bethlehem, but currently lives here in the Boston area with his wife and two children. We sat down with Nidal to talk about the work he has done here and the Aida refugee camp in Palestine. Nidal, increasingly water is becoming a world issue of concern, even in the United States, and not only in Flint, Michigan, where the crisis is severe, but in California, the Southwest, with issues even being raised in the Northeast. That being said, our crisis is nowhere near what Palestinians face every day. Your organization, One for Three, is in the forefront of not only trying to call attention to the crisis, but is overtly doing something about developing a model of response to this crisis in the Aida refugee camp in Bethlehem. Let's start with describing what Palestinians face on a daily basis, a water crisis of epic proportions. I'd like to start with you describing that crisis for those of us who may not know much about it, especially Israel's role in its creation and maintenance.
Thank you. Thank you, John. And as we all know, water is a vehicle for life, you know. And in Palestine, especially in the West Bank side, Israel take advantage of the importance of water for Palestinians and use it as, let's say, as a weapon, as a tool to not punish as a collective punishment, but also to force displace Palestinians from their areas, especially in the Area C, where much of the agricultural land is, and actually where much of the aquifers and underground water sits. It's in Area C. And we all know that Area C is about 62% of the West Bank. And it's fully controlled under Israel, under the Israeli military and civil administrations. Mm-hmm. And from the beginning, you know, Israel sets the rule that whoever live in Area C has to live under these restrictions of, like, if you need to build anything, any infrastructure, if you need to build a house, if you need to build a room for an animal, if you need to dig a cistern to harvest the rainwater from the rooftop. If you need to do anything, you need to apply for a permit from the Israelis. And it's almost impossible to get this permit. And many Palestinians go ahead and build and do infrastructures. And whatever they build, it will be destroyed by the Israeli army. But farmers are water and land are related always, especially for farmers. And not only farmers who farm the land, but farmers who have animals. You know, for example, we look at the Area C, where much of the agricultural land sits, but also where the Jordan Valley area is, where the Bedouin lives, where much of the farmers who produce vegetables to Area B and A, which, you know, Area A is controlled by the Palestinian Authority. Because Area A is the build-up area where Palestinians build homes, buildings, businesses. There's not much land in Area A for agriculture. Area C, you cannot build, you have empty land. And even though farmers have limited access to this land, but they do farm it and they sell their vegetables. And Israel here use the water to really force the farmers to leave their land.
So abandon the land.
Take example, the Jordan Valley. It's in a clear case. And other and southern Hebron also, the Hebron Hills and other areas, Area C, where Israel will shut the water for the farmers in Area C. And farmers, this is their living. You know, if there's no water, they cannot do farming, they cannot support their animals or themselves, you know. So they end up moving to Area B and Area A. All of a sudden, settlers will start moving in to Area C, and all of a sudden, water comes back and the land is green again. So this is a systematic, you know, a system by Israel to force these Palestinians and replace them with settlers and settlements. And this is a fact. It's not like a fantasy or a propaganda or something like that. These are facts on the grounds, are heavily, heavily documented by international organizations, even by Israeli human rights organizations, not only by Palestinians, because you cannot really deny it.
And if under Israeli law, if you abandon or leave a land for what is 2 or 3 years, they consider it abandoned, and under absentee law, then they take it over. So they drive them off, and then they take their land.
The absentee law, it's destroyed 8 Jerusalem. Hmm. Absentee law, you know, the refugees who were forced actually to leave the around Jerusalem, especially in 67 areas, all their properties, houses and land were taken based on this law. And this law somehow applies in the rest of the West Bank, you know, especially in Area C. But one more thing too, and here's the strange, odd thing that also heavily documented. The amount of water that's available in the West Bank, Israel takes 80% of it to itself. Between 75 to 80% of it to itself. Let's say they leave 25% for Palestinians. Yet they take 10% of which, of the 25%, and they give it to settlers. So they leave around between 15 to 18, sometimes 20% for Palestinians to use. But the summer season is very dry. And the summer season, this is where the crisis hits Palestinians. Not only in Area C, in Area A and B, you know, the Palestinian Authority areas. And here, if you look at the demography and the geography of the West Bank and see how fast the settlement constructions are moving in the West Bank, this number, it will increase. Mm-hmm. Increase because settlers are increasing, the number of settlers are increasing, but also to build a settlement, you need to consume a lot of water. So the Palestinian share of water, it will decrease. Will become maybe 15 or less than 15% of their own water. This is the thing. We're talking about Palestinian water under their feet that they cannot touch, they're not allowed to use, and it's controlled by Israel. So, with these circumstances, what do we do? What Palestinians do? You know, they have the occupations, they have so many economical restrictions based on Paris agreements and other agreements that they were forced to accept. And you left, you know, some good organizations with the local communities to be mobilized. Mm-hmm. To challenge these obstacles. Yes, it's a political thing, you know, not only the Palestinians, the international community need to react to this crisis to force Israel to stop these violations and have at least shared or equal distributions of the resources. Not to give it back if they don't want to, but at least they had it to have equal distributions of the resources. So the communities in the West Bank, you know, this is the time where they need to get organized and take over things and do it the way they want. And this is where we here at 143 with our partners in Palestine, in Aida Camp, in Al-Azza Camp, and in Walajab village have decided to do 5 or 6 years ago. We decided not to play other major foundations or organizations game, which is to go to needed Palestinian communities with a plan and policy and a budget and to force it into the community. No. We decided to do it differently, which is to go to the community and listen directly from the community and have the community be a partner with you. Have them involved in every step of the way, involved in the planning, involved in the idea. They have to own the work and they have to run it. You know, it is not anymore the Western communities or foundations. They go to these locations and they want to teach people how to do things or how to survive or things like that. Yeah. No, people are smart, highly skilled, and capable of doing so much. And the past 6 years, they proved so much to us. So really, when we went, I remember when we went the first time, yes, we located a great partner that's very well respected among the community, but this was not enough, really. We required to meet with the communities, men, women, children, youth, and to hear it directly from them. But they also told us, you know, it's wonderful you're here. Solidarity is very important. But what we need right now is a partner that will continue the relationship for years with us. Not a relationship that will end whenever the budget or the project ends. No, we need a continuing relationship, a partnership. We share the failure, we share the success, we share the ideas and everything. And that by itself proved to empower the communities because they own it. And really, something is working in their life. So they really love it because it involves families, it involves youth. And believe me, to get youth in refugee camps to be interested in science, education, and projects is a tough one. Because we work in, for example, Ayda refugee camp is the second most tense refugee camp in the West Bank. And it is the highest recipients of tear gas in the world based on the UC Berkeley School of Law research last year. They did like a research to find, you know, the use of tear gas in the world, and they found Ayda refugee camp is the highest recipients of tear gas. And just for the sake of saying it again and again, this tear gas comes from the factory in Pennsylvania here in the US.
Right.
Travels all the way to Palestine to be used based on our tax dollars, etc., etc., etc. So because of that, what we learned, because, you know, this is the time where the community will teach us something. And I am, as a Palestinian, was born and raised there, so I'm playing the two sides.
Yeah.
Living here, walking with one for three, another group here, and going there with internationals and professionals and things like that. So the community is really tired. Look, I know it. Palestinians are really tired. They appreciate solidarity, but they're really tired of internationals coming and do it themselves. They really need to be involved and be... they want to have their space to own it.
Right.
So, and we really realized that from the very beginning, we learned from it, and we saw how important for empowerment. You know, these people live under such horrific situation. At the refugee camp, Al-Azhar refugee camp, Dehesha, Balata, you name it, you know, overcrowded, always target to the Israeli occupations. The incarceration, especially among young folks, is very, very high. The unemployment is between 35% to 40% in these locations, which is, it's big, it's huge, it's really horrendous. And the only thing you can provide, you can do to these communities is to give them the chance to do it themselves. And for example,
and that makes it sustainable. What you're looking for is sustainability when the when the organizations, the nonprofit organizations go, when the money goes. You're trying to develop a system that is sustainable going into the future.
That's true. Yeah. So first we went, you know, the community told us, because it has to come from the community, not from us. They told us we have a problem with water, which is a huge problem in the summer. And we have a problem with health. We don't have a clinic in either refugee camp or Gaza refugee camp, and the health system that is available for us is the UNRWA clinic and the government hospital, which both are really provide low quality health services. And the issue of agriculture, you know, because originally they're farmers, and but they don't have land, left land, because the wall took the only open land from them, and the house, the camp is like a jungle of concrete, let's say it this way. There's not much space to do things. And from the very beginning, we said, okay, we need to teach ourselves how to do things, and we need to run it, but also we need to figure a way how to sustain it at some point without the fund from the U.S. So we start with the water project, water testing, to improve the quality and the quantity of the camp. And we did 2.5 years of ongoing workshops, education, water testing, and that. A very high-quality job, you know, with partnerships with the WIS program at Tufts University.
And
an incredible team from Aida and Gaza refugee camp, who together made a really like a small revolution to improve the water quality. And why do we have, we should mention why do we have low quality there in the water. And this is due to the lack of water. You know, when Israel don't give water to the Palestinian Authority, you know, these locations will be off without water for 2 weeks, 2 months or more. In one of the summers we were there, Aida camp did not receive water for over 71 days.
Unbelievable.
So these metals and these water tanks will get rusted.
Yeah.
So any kind of contamination is going to grow there.
Yeah.
So our job was is really to launch a huge campaign to first expose the program, mobilize the community, and tell, because it's not enough to go to the community and tell them you have a problem with water. They will tell you, so what?
Yeah, they know
so
that.
You know that.
Yeah.
But no, here's the problem. Here's its effects on your health. And it's not only the Israelis are responsible for that. Yes, mainly the Israelis, but also the UNRWA needs to act and the Palestinian Authority needs to act. You need to get mobilized, organized, and go challenge. And this is part of the sustainability. So after 2.5 years of work where we really managed to decrease the contamination of water and increase the quantity a little bit, because we need to remember quantity is in the hand of the occupation. The occupation is to end to have your water. You know, as far as you have the occupation's control, the aquifers and everything, it's impossible to fix the quantity of water. So after that, we went and we built a Palestinian chain of support for these programs, where major Palestinian organizations and donors will sustain these programs. And now, for almost 18 months, these programs have been sustained locally, the water and the rooftop gardens, which is it's something new, you know, something it's really to be proud of.
Yeah.
It's to cut your reliance on the, especially the Western money to Palestine, other places in the world. And this really inspired us in 143. This is a very successful model. So we start moving it into another refugee camp, Gaza. And now we are in the process of moving it in El Walaja village, which is another extremely difficult case for us. We thought Aida camp is tough. El Walaja is 10 times harder than. But we cannot turn our back on it. We have to
and
do
very
something.
Close to Aida. Walaja is right outside of Beit Jala, Bethlehem.
It's
right there.
It sits on the border of 48.
Yeah, it does.
80% of its area C. Only a small circle, 20% in the middle, area B. Surrounded by a wall, settlements, house demolitions, theft of water, you name it.
Yeah.
You know? So it's a tough case, but, you know, we have to do something. We cannot just. And we did. We did a lot of infrastructure, not building, like foundational work with Tufts and other groups. We created an environmental unit. We established a lab. We trained youth and everything. And now we're in the process of doing the research, because everything has to be done with a really thorough research before you start investing or doing any work. Yeah. So really now, we walk based on people's demands, and then we jump to the rooftop gardens. When people came to us about the rooftop gardens, they told us it's not about food, really. It's not only about food. Yes, it will help a lot of families food-wise, but it's about three things. Because originally we're farmers, it's really nice. Everybody is good at farming there. It's like something, I don't say it naturally, it's just like everybody is good at farming there. So they want to keep this part of the culture, for the identity of the history alive, especially among the young kids. And it's for food, but also they said it's for women. You know? How? So we start with one pilot rooftop garden on top of Lajee Center. Succeeded big time. We built four more and add a refugee camp. Each family saved close to between 50 to 55% on their reliance to outside produce. So they saved a lot of money. Fully run by the women of these families. And it was the most beautiful things to see how this space is like, it's the mother and her children's space. They farm, they produce food, they eat from it. She feels contributing to the house income. It's very, very beautiful. And all of a sudden, we start getting requests from a lot of families. So we start reaching out to Palestinian foundations and Palestinian families. And now we are close to 40 rooftop gardens in the two camps. And now we need to sustain it. So we went to a major Palestinian organizations who works on water and agriculture. It's Arij Institute, Applied Institutes. It's in Beit Sahour. And we said, as a Palestinian organization, you have the resources, you need to step in. They agreed. Amazing. It's beautiful. And the rooftop gardens for almost a year, it has been sustained by them. Now, by the end of the year, we should have close to 65 or 70 rooftop gardens in Aida and Azra refugee camp. One of the most beautiful projects.
Yeah.
It's really nice. It's really nice. And it's in the rooftops. Why? Because you don't have land or in open spaces in the refugee camps. And because the houses there are built out of concrete and stone and iron, so they can carry a lot of weight, you know? And we designed them very carefully to consume less water, to produce almost 8 months of the year organic vegetables. Each family is very well trained on how to plant it and the carbs throughout the seasons and how to take care of it and develop it. And it's a source of living, so practically. Yeah. And it's not a small one. It's really a big one. To the point where, you know, some of the families will have extra. You know, family sizes, you know, different there. You have medium, big, small families. And the small, medium families, usually they will have extra produce. They will give it to neighbors, to other part of the families, which is something really beautiful to create. And this really bonded a lot of people together and strengthened the connections with the families. And it's, again, for them, something is working in their life in the midst of this horrible conditions.
How in the summer, when there's this terrible water crisis, how are they dealing with adequate water to, you know, to maintain their gardens?
Two things. To solve, this is where we came into this scene. First, our partner organization, Lajee Center, suffers a lot in the summer. And they work with hundreds of children and families throughout the year. But the summer season is heavy because children don't have school. So they have a lot of programs. So the first thing we did, we built a 50 cubic meter cistern to harvest the rainwater in the winter and store it. And treat it, because we have an environmental unit trained with a lab. They can treat the water and use it for the summer. So Lajee Center...
Now, did Israel give you any trouble in terms of building the cistern?
Because this is area, we
you're
insist
in area
to build
B?
In area A.
You're in area,
the Lajee Center, the street, is area C, in front of Lajee. The building, a quarter of the building is area C. Behind the building is Bethlehem District, Area A. So we built the cistern there.
Oh my God.
It costed a little bit more, but it has been there. And legislature.
So if you build it in front in the street, it would be Area C, and they probably would have torn.
They did destroy the stage that was built near the wall in the camp, a stage for people. And this is, they built it for the Pope when they came to visit the camp, because they wanted to host him there. So they demolished it. And they last year, actually, two people from the Boston area, two women, volunteered to plant trees with the Environment Unit in Ida Camp in Area C. I'm talking about Ida Camp. The army came and uprooted and took all the trees out. So, but since we built this cistern, Ledger Center never ever ran out of water, and the programs are running. So this gave us, it's working, you know, so...
Now this is not potable water, but you can use it, right?
You can use it for drinking, for everything, because we have an Environment Unit who was very well trained by the wonderful team from Tufts, I'll give them the credit, how to treat the water.
Oh, okay. Of course. Even the cistern water, you can...
Yeah, you can drink it. You can drink it. It's safe. We have been drinking it since we built it years ago.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Wow. So, for the farmers, for the rooftop gardens, and for other families who struggle mostly in the summer, we, during our fundraising and walks for waters we did in the Boston area, we managed to build 185 cubic meter cistern next to the 50 cubic cisterns for the camp. So families who needs water for these rooftop gardens, or other families who don't have water in the summer for a long time, they will come and take water from this system. So this was another inspiration, you know, encouraging thing. You know, it's very hard. You work so hard for things to work there, to see the results and the effects on people there. And when you see it, you realize that you're doing something good. So you keep going. So the last thing we're working on now is the health. This is the third request that came from the community. Ida Camp doesn't have, and Al-Azza Camp doesn't have, they don't have a clinic. And especially for elderly, to go to all the way behind the Hishr Camp for the honorable clinic, which provide low quality services, and the government hospital really needs a lot of work. This created a gap between communities, the refugee population, and the health system. And they have a third option, which is the private sector, but the majority of the people we work with, they cannot afford the private sector. It's expensive for them. So we really partnered with this incredible team of doctors, actually from Partners in Health. The teams that worked with Paul Farmer, they did programs in Haiti and other parts of the world, and this program is really here, led by Dr. Bram Whispelway, and actually he's flying to the site to the camp tomorrow. He went with Dr. David Scale, another doctor, to Palestine, and they did almost 2 years of research. Because this is how we work. We have to do a lot of research before we start the project. We need to study the private sector, the honorary clinic, the medical system, interview with people. And then at the end they said, okay, we a working program or model has to be the community health worker. Because they tried it in other parts of the world, it works. So we decided to run 6 months test for this program. We hired 6 community health workers from Ida and Al-Azza refugee camp, 4 young women and 2 young men. And in 6 months, they really made a huge progress. This is based on family visits, regulating medicines. And it's worth to say that based on the research, we found out that the highest 2 diseases in Palestine is diabetes and hypertension. You know, so the focus right now on these 2 things. Now the program is almost a year. We started with 6 community health workers with 55 or 60 patients. Now we added 100 patients. We added 2 community health workers. We have a manager. We have a physician and a staff nurse director for this program. and it is really making a huge difference in people's health, okay, people's lives. It's really incredible. We have a lot of documentations and videos and reports online about that. And it's inspiring because we start getting like a buzz and news from other locations in the West Bank, you know, asking us, oh, this is very interesting. Do you think you can come and do it with us next year or 2 years? Right now, we work in 2 locations. And hopefully, by the end of this year, we'll manage to add another 200 patients into this program. And next year, hopefully, we can add another location. You know, because it's incredible. And then after that, you will start thinking about the sustainability. Because first you need to build the program,
right,
have it running, prove that it is working, and then you go to the players, in this case to the UNRWA, to the local communities, to the medical providers, and tell them, it is your responsibility. Look, we build a beautiful, strong program. Like really good, very, it has affiliation with top health providers in the world. So let's take care of it ourselves, that we can either move to other locations or start with other initiatives that Palestinians want us to start with.
Now, talking about sustainability, you're sponsoring a Walk for Water, which is a fundraiser to try to raise money specifically for this project.
Yes. So each year this is the fourth year that we are doing Walk for Water in support of Palestinian refugees. And it is Walk for Water because water is a vehicle for all the programs, but this walk also funds the medical and the early child education program.
So it's the whole ball game, yeah.
Yeah. So, but it is the main source of funding for this program.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really want to take a closer look on the importance of these programs, go to the Walk for Water website or the Facebook page or 143, and you can see all the reports, documentations, to get in touch with me to see like how important these programs are and how important the Walk for Water is to support these programs. So it is a fundraising,
mm-hmm,
but also it brings a lot of people together, between 350 to 400 people, to walk together for a great cause. So many organizations, different people from different walks of life, they come together. And their giving is not only, you know, a contribution, it's also a political participation. The whole scene, the whole day at the walk, it's an opportunity to connect with people, to connect with organizations, but also to know that your money, your contributions going to really great, very well studied, very well run programs in Palestine.
Yeah, as a participant in this for the last 4 years,
I know,
I can attest to the incredible feeling that this event projects. You just become a part of something you feel that is not only important, but you meet people who are involved in this, and it can change you. And for those of us that sit and watch and say to ourselves, what can I do? It's hard to know sometimes. You feel powerless in terms of what can I do? And an event like this comes along, answers the question, what can I do?
Yeah.
I can go out, I can be a part of this, not only the raising of the money, but a part of the whole movement, a part of the whole resistance.
It's part of the whole movement and the resistance. And you will be amazed like how many wonderful people we recruit who have engineering backgrounds, medical backgrounds, experience in water and agriculture, also will be like interested to be involved. And all of a sudden, you'll see them traveling with us to Palestine or traveling alone to Palestine to volunteer or help in these projects on the ground. So it's also an opportunity to get involved in this work this way.
So if I want to get involved, Can I just Google 1-for-3?
If you can go to 1-for-3, there is a link for the walk there.
Okay.
And also, you can type walk for water in support of Palestinian refugees.
Okay.
1-for-3, and we'll take you to that walk website, and you can. The walk is going to be in Cambridge, in West Kendall Street. The route will be on Charles River. You know, we'll be walking near the water, so it's a beautiful walk. It's 5K. We will have like music. We'll have excellent foods. We'll have prizes. We'll have just a wonderful feeling.
So it's May 4th.
It's May 4th. All the information online, and you have me and other members of the team always available to help, direct, walk you every step of the way to do it and walk with us.
Great, great. And I would encourage people to do that.
Yes.
It's a marvelous, marvelous event. Well, Nadal, thank you very much.
Thank you. That's wonderful.
Thank you for the work you do. And thank you for the way you've involved us. Appreciate it.
No, thank you so much, John. And looking forward to see you and see all of you and more of you soon at the walk.
It's a deal.
Yeah.
That was our interview with Nadal Al-Azraq, Executive Director of the organization 1-for-3. Please consider joining us for the Walk for Water sponsored by 1-for-3, which is to raise money for these very important projects in the West Bank that Nadal has been talking about. The walk is May 4th in Cambridge. To get information and to register for the walk, just Google 1for3.org. That's 1for3.org. You can do something to mitigate the water crisis in Palestine by joining us in the Walk for Water. Before we go, we want to take a look at the latest military assault on Gaza, which took place in mid-March. Israel again overreacted to rather harmless rockets that they claimed were fired by Hamas, although Hamas has denied it. This is the latest in a long list of bombardments that Israel has rained on Gaza in the last several years. I want to play a response to these attacks by Ali Abu Nima of the Electronic Intifada, speaking on Al Jazeera, which puts the issue in perspective. Here is Ali Abu Nima.
Well, let's get more on this now. Joining us from Chicago is Ali Abu Nima, co-founder of the news website Electronic Intifada, also the author of One Country and The Battle for Justice in Palestine. Mr. Abu Nima, always good to have you with us on Al Jazeera. What do you make of the Israeli account that this was a standard operation that went wrong? Why would Israel risk such an operation at a time that the UN and Egypt were making progress in de-escalating tensions?
Well, that's exactly the question. And if this were an isolated incident, it might be easier to accept the Israeli explanation that this was not intended to be an assassination raid or a kidnapping raid. But Israel has, unfortunately, a pattern of sabotaging ceasefire agreements. It's almost 10 years to the day that Israel launched a similar attack in Gaza, killing 6 members of Hamas. This was on November 5th, 2008. That ended a 4-month ceasefire and led directly to the Operation Cast Lead, in which Israel massacred 1,400 Palestinians. And you'd think that after Israel violated numerous ceasefires with similar results, that they would have learned the lesson. But it seems that the Israeli leaders are pyromaniacs. They cannot tolerate calm. They cannot tolerate that people in Gaza live in anything like peace. And so they carried out this reckless and destructive raid and are now subjecting people in Gaza to terror and killing and bombing. But they've also subjected their own Israeli population to the retaliatory and operations of the Palestinian resistance factions.
And Hamas has released this video, they've said, of them attacking this bus once it was emptied of Israeli soldiers. They know what kind of retaliation an actual attack on Israeli soldiers would lead to. So what is Hamas doing here?
Well, I think what Hamas has done, it should be contrasted with what Israel does, because for months Israel has been murdering women, children, medics, journalists with snipers, unarmed people across the boundary. It's not an international border. Al Jazeera should stop calling it a border. Across the boundary into Gaza, using snipers to murder unarmed civilians. And here, what we saw today on the video was that Hamas had within its sights a bus full of Israeli soldiers. It could have fired at that bus when it was full, which would have been an entirely legitimate attack against a military target. But instead, it allowed all the soldiers to disembark from the bus, all except one who was injured, in order to send a message to Israel that, look, we have the capability to inflict tremendous damage to you, but we do not want an escalation. And that has been the consistent message from the resistance factions in Gaza. But we see that Israel is incapable and unwilling to live in peace and calm with Palestinians. Israel just is allergic to calm and ceasefire.
Well, how do you think that they are going to respond to this message? Because the Israeli Security Cabinet is meeting on Tuesday to decide what their next steps will be. We know that Prime Minister Netanyahu is under pressure from those who are even more hawkish than he is. Is he going to give in to that pressure, you know, to that mow the lawn strategy that Israeli ministers have encouraged towards Gaza, where they propose basically flattening it every few years?
Yes, well, of course, Israel is riven by tribalism and factionalism and religious extremism. So you have a defense minister, Avigdor Lieberman, who is one of the most extreme and violent politicians in the world today, who has been saying for months that he wants to carry out a large-scale attack on Gaza. And we've seen other members of the government calling for more restraint, not out of any sympathy with Palestinians, but because they know that carrying out another massacre will only increase the isolation of Israel and indeed will increase the determination of Palestinians to defend themselves and resist. So Israel doesn't really have a strategy here. What we've seen the UN and others trying to broker is some kind of long-term truce. Remember, we're talking about this now because rockets were flying into Israel. But the violence from Israel against Palestinians is constant. Since the beginning of the year, Israel has killed more than 200 Palestinians in Gaza, the vast majority of them unarmed civilians. And the violence of the siege continues to take Palestinian lives and livelihoods. So there was an effort to come up with a truce that would relieve the siege and allow Palestinians to live. And what we've seen is somebody in Israel, I don't know whether it's Netanyahu or the defense minister Lieberman or some other extremist or saboteur, who decided to send this commando squad into Gaza to blow everything up. But let us hope that history doesn't repeat itself and that this cycle of insanity and bloodshed and death started by Israel can be brought to a quick halt.
Mr. Abu Nima, thank you very much for your time, for your views on this. That is Ali Abu Nima live in Chicago. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Ali Abu Nima of the Electronic Intifada, speaking on Al Jazeera in response to Israel's constant bombardment of Gaza. And that is all the time we have this week. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to Truth and Justice Radio and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.